Welcome to Take Note from WPSU. I'm Shireen Stanford. This episode of Take Note is part of State of Emergency, searching for solutions to Pennsylvania's opioid epidemic. State of Emergency is a combined effort of newsrooms across the state to draw attention to programs, therapies, and strategies that are showing promise in the fight against this public health crisis. Danielle Dormer is a mother and Army veteran in long-term recovery from drug and alcohol use. She uses her experience to help Penn State students, serving as the assistant program coordinator for the collegiate recovery community. She's also earning her master's degree in clinical rehabilitation and mental health counseling at Penn State, where she completed her undergraduate degree in 2017, earning a 4.0 GPA and the Outstanding Adult Student Award. Danielle Dormer, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Take us back to the day when you first hit rock bottom. Can you describe that moment for us?
I can kind of remember what led up to the moment. And what led up to the moment is this thought process of just trying to escape reality, just not having really a stable place to live, stable relationships. So going out and partying, getting high, that's what is attractive in those moments because it's the only thing that feels good. I can't remember so much the process of that night of getting to that point, but I can remember waking up on a piece of concrete in the middle of Philadelphia, unable to move my body, but fully conscious in my mind. It was sheer terror. The second I was able to start moving, I got up desperate and willing to do something different. And it was that event that led me into the Army recruiting office.
Why did you go into the Army recruiting office? What led you there?
I'll tell you, all my options were exhausted at that point. And I'm not even quite sure why I thought the Army was a option at that point. But I knew I wanted to do better. I knew I wasn't someone. I had already dropped out of high school. I couldn't face trying to go back. I wasn't able to do it the first time. I'd say maybe it was some pride in the way of not being able to go back to that high school and say I wanted to try again. But again, I didn't have a stable living environment. I didn't have the support to succeed in high school. So the Army just seemed like a way to go. The narrative around me about the military was be all you can be. I had heard the stories of people or individuals enlisting in the military who were a lot like me, who had no place to go, who were trying to escape a troubled youth. And I didn't have a criminal record, which I am very grateful for, because unfortunately, a lot of the people that start picking up drugs and alcohol at a young age, they have criminal records, and then that blocks them from opportunities. So I marched myself in there.
And you said that the recruitment officer didn't judge you. So how did you feel judged before that, and why did that feel like a welcoming space?
So I'll tell you, in my process of, so I was emancipated as a youth. I was 16 years old when I was emancipated. I had tried to live life on my own. I had tried to stay in high school, obtain employment, but it's really difficult. And I felt and I can remember even when I went in to drop out from high school, there was no loving support. There was no asking of why or encouragement to stay. It was just sign this paper and you're done. So I guess I internalized that as people just trying to get rid of me. And to be honest with you, I was trying to get rid of myself. So when that Army recruiter just kind of laughed at my appearance and was so willing to work with me, it was exactly what I needed.
And you said you were emancipated. Can you explain to people what that means?
Yeah, so for me, what that means is my childhood was troubled. There was some abuse at home. So with the help of a lawyer, I was able to petition the court instead of having to go into a foster care system, that I was able to provide my own living. So I was given an access card and Medicaid and went on my way.
So when you got into the military, you ended up spending about 10 years?
Yeah, my service spanned about 10 years.
And you said that your time in the military was probably good and bad for your addictions.
Yeah, as a teenager, my drugs of choice were narcotics. I did a lot of drugs. I did, we don't need to go through all the drugs I did, but you name them, I probably did them. Alcohol really wasn't a big thing for me because it's easy, if believe it or not, on the streets of Philadelphia in my day and age, and I'm sure it's the same, it's easier for a teenager to get drugs than it is alcohol. So once I got into the military, I dropped the idea of using drugs. I was so grateful to have a family, a community, a place to sleep at night. I had not really had those things yet. But I welcomed in this idea of alcohol because that's what people were doing around me. I still hadn't processed any of the things that had happened to me as a youth, that had happened to me during my use. I never really fully addressed the fact that I had substance use disorder. And it became acceptable as an 18, 19-year-old stationed in Germany to go out drinking on the weekends. So that's really what my addiction, it did not go away. It just transformed.
Right now, you describe yourself as being in long-term recovery. What do you mean by that? What does that mean?
So in the past with substance use disorder, we've heard people self-describe as, I'm an alcoholic or I'm an addict. For me, that still gives the power to the drug. It still gives the power. It's the individual identifying with the substance. I don't want that for myself, and I don't want that for anybody else that has substance use disorder. I want them to identify with their recovery. So when I identify in public, I say I'm an individual in long-term recovery. I give the power to the solution, not the problem.
And how long have you been in recovery?
I've been in recovery for 2.5 years now.
You're particular about the language that is used around this issue. So, for example, reinforcing the idea of addiction as a disease, yes. Talking about substance use as a disorder. Why is that, even those things, why is that even important?
It's so important to me because the number one thing where we have to start in healing our communities is we have to start with stigma reduction. And I believe it's difficult to reduce any kind of stigma when we're using the terminology of addiction and alcoholic and abuse. When I hear abuse, I think of a choice. I think of an individual doing something wrong. I don't think of an individual that needs help, that is sick. So if we go to a more inclusive language, I believe we can start to reduce the stigma.
You're very upfront also about acknowledging some of the privileges that you said you had in not getting in as much trouble as other people, maybe who are of a different race than you, different
yes.
gender. Talk about that and how you think that kept you out of having a criminal record, for example.
Yeah, I welcome the opportunity to talk about that. Basically, what that looks like is I'm an individual. If you look at me, I am a woman. I am a white woman. So when I talk about that, kept me out of a criminal record. I was at many parties. I was in many cars that were pulled over. I was at parties that were raided by police officers. They would look at me, and I got let go. My peers that were using with me, if they looked like a man or a woman of color, guess what they got? They got handcuffs and they got carted off. But they were just as sick as I was. So now we have put individuals that have substance use disorder in prison. we've stunted their growth. 15, 16, 17 years old, they're going to juvenile detention centers, they're going to state, county incarceration. Where's the opportunity to build life, to build purpose? I got that in part because of the way I look, and I don't think that's fair, and I think that we need to change that.
And now you're in a position, you're the assistant program coordinator for the Collegiate Recovery Community. Can you talk about what that is and how it helps?
We support individuals as they strive to obtain an education so they can develop purpose and meaning in their life, so a life of drug and alcohol use doesn't seem more appealing to them. Who needs that the most? Who needs that the most are the individuals who have not seen that in their family, who have not had that opportunity, the individuals that have been incarcerated. What I want to do here at Penn State, what I see us doing here at Penn State every day, is we are building a recovery community that is inclusive. We're reaching out to the community. We're speaking wherever we get an opportunity to speak. And we're learning from our mistakes. We're not perfect. But we're learning from our mistakes, and hopefully we can build these principles and build this community so we can bring this down to all of the Commonwealth campuses. And even a further dream for me is to get collegiate recovery programs in our community colleges, our high schools. Everywhere you have a group of individuals, you're most likely going to have a group of individuals that are also using. And for them to make the choice not to use, I want to make it attractive. I want to make a life in recovery look worth living.
What are the things that you guys can do to help people on a college campus?
Yeah, so we have a large college campus that we operate our collegiate recovery program on. That's University Park at Penn State. And there's a number of bars. There's a number of drinking events around town. So what we give the students is alternative events, alternative peer groups. What we give students, something to do on a Friday night, on a Saturday night, other than just sit in their room and watch Netflix or play Call of Duty and think about how they're missing out. We do social events. We do educational programming. Sometimes we're just sitting around chatting. But together, we are stronger than any one of us sitting in our room all alone feeling isolated. Because isolation, feeling isolated, feeling like you're different, you're separate from the whole, we know that brings people back out. But feeling like you have a community of support, that you have a family, people that are invested in your recovery, we know that that maintains long-term recovery.
And is there, you guys can all live together too, there's housing for it. Is that an important part of it?
I believe it's an important component. Here at Penn State, we have 16 students in long-term recovery living together, making meals together, learning how to have relationships together. I mean, that's a lot of the part of substance use disorder is you don't quite know how to be in a relationship. So we're giving these young adults the opportunity to build relationships, supportive, lifelong friends, the same opportunities that the college students are getting on campus and in fraternities and sororities and housing, we're giving the individuals that are in recovery.
Why are you doing this kind of work?
Sorry, I'm getting choked up because I think back to myself. And I think back to that 16-year-old girl that was lying on that piece of concrete in Philadelphia who didn't know what recovery looked like. I didn't have anyone around me showing me anything different. And I don't want any little girl or little boy to have to live that life. I don't want them to feel isolated or alone. So I stand up and I speak out, and I will continue to do that. I don't know if it's just love or purpose, but I've been given the opportunity. I've been given an education. I remember that feeling of thinking to myself, I'm not one of those people. And now that I have this education, I want everyone that's sitting there thinking they're never going to be one of these people to know you can be. That's why I do it.
Do you ever think about the 16-year-old who dropped out of high school and now you're earning your master's degree? I mean, does that seem unreal to you a little bit?
It seems very unreal to me. It still, you know, it chokes me up when I think about it. And I think a lot of the work I do is about giving back to me, because I am so grateful for it. I would have never imagined it.
There's a lot of media attention right now, in particular around opioid addictions. There's documentaries, TV specials, WPSU. We're going to be launching a big project about opioid use. But I always wonder, what is it that we're missing? We in the media, when we talk about something like the opioid crisis, or if you haven't experienced it directly in your family, what are we missing when we talk about it?
Yeah, I could talk for a while about what everybody's missing, so you can feel free to jump in and provide me direction. Number one thing we need to start with is every generation has a substance crisis. So this generation right now, it's opiates. Let's not forget the generation that incarcerated many men of color when it was crack and it was cocaine. So what we're talking about here right now in the opiate crisis, one is we're talking about the opiate crisis because the truth of the matter is there are children of privilege, teenagers dying out in the suburbs. So now we're talking about it. But I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for any conversation that brings up the concept of recovery. So as we talk about the opiate crisis, let's not forget that we're talking about recovery. It's more than Narcan. It's more than medication-assisted treatment. We're talking about engaging people in long-term recovery. We don't solve the opiate crisis. We don't solve anything until we can build communities of support that make a life in recovery worth living.
What are some of the factors that have led to you being successful in recovery?
So for my recovery, what it looked like was I was working on healing the trauma, on healing the reasons why I was using, but at the same time, I was developing purpose by coming back to school. So my recovery program was very comprehensive. I was getting success in school, so I was feeling, okay, I can do this. I can do this. So I was able to go to counseling and go to treatment, ready to dig into the hard stuff because I could see a light. Through education, I could see, okay, if I graduate, I can get a job. So it made going through the pain worth it. But if we're just carting people into treatment and not developing purpose simultaneously by workforce development or education, why look at that pain? Why is it worth it? What's the best they're going to go to? So I believe that recovery programs, treatment programs, they have to be comprehensive. We have to work with people to build a life. We don't just give them treatment and send them back out on the street.
And you've done a 12-step recovery. Has that been part of yours?
Yes. And again, my recovery program is comprehensive. I've done 12-step recovery. I've done individual counseling, vocational rehabilitation with the VA. The recovery path has to be individual. Any kind of cookie-cutter approach, it just doesn't work. So treatment episodes, the 28 days for acute care crisis, I understand that you know, sometimes looks like a cookie cutter approach. But what needs to happen, what I believe needs to happen, and some treatment centers are doing this successfully, is when you're coming to the end of your treatment episode, a career counselor, maybe it's a collegiate recovery program, you're developing a long-term plan. And in some cases, you're getting a peer support recovery specialist is coming in, and they're going to follow you after treatment. They're going to follow up with you and see how you're maintaining some of these goals.
So what does recovery look like day to day? Because I think you're obviously a success story, but it's not some easy thing where like, oh, now I'm in recovery, the end. I mean, what does it look like in practice every single day?
Yeah. Recovery is an everyday decision, which again brings me back to say, why do we treat it with just acute care? Where we treat substance use disorder with treatment episodes, and then we give no long-term care. I'm able to be successful in my recovery because I have received an education and I understand the utility of recovery supports. That's not the case for a lot of individuals. So for me, it looks like I go to 12-step meetings. I meet with other individuals in recovery. I have coffee. I get a chance to share my experience, my strength, my hope. When I'm not feeling hopeful, right, because I have bad days, I'm not this bright and cheery every day, I have people to call that I know have been there too. There is not a situation on this planet that an individual in recovery has not faced. I just need to be in contact with those people. I need to know who to reach out to. We need to continue to build our recovery community. I believe that we're doing that. The 12-step community has recently embraced medication assistance. We're looking at more inclusive terminology, like saying I'm an individual in long-term recovery. You have people out here with lived experience in recovery working around the clock to build supportive communities that they're not getting reimbursed for. Nobody's making money off this. And it's just a matter. That's what it's a matter of building the community of support.
And then do you have to say no to certain things, stay away from certain situations?
I do. So if we go back and think about my veteran identity, that's still with me. It's with me very strong. I'm still working to figure out what that's going to look like moving forward, because it's very difficult for me to be with my fellow veterans. A lot of the situations, social situations for veterans are, hey, you're having a bad day, let's grab a beer. Let's go to the VFW, down to the Legion, and grab a beer. And we sit there on a bar stool, and we tell our stories. I don't miss the beer, but I miss the friendship. I miss my veteran community. They get it. They've seen the things I've seen. They understand my mindset. But sometimes I feel really disconnected from them, because I haven't quite, even at 2.5 years of recovery, figured out how I engage with that community without being triggered, without wanting to pick up that beer. That's difficult. But for me, I have a recovery community through collegiate recovery programs, through advocacy that I do, that I can balance that with.
And your son's a teenager now.
Yes.
Your eldest son. How do you talk to him about drugs and things like that?
So when my son was going into high school, his very first day of school, I sat out front of my house with him and I tried to sell him drugs. Not actual drugs. This is all pretend and role play. And he kept saying, Mom, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? I wanted to expose him. He needed to be exposed to the idea. Granted, I probably didn't approach him in the ways in which he will be approached, but I planted a seed. What I think we do with a lot of our teenagers is we have parents out here that are completely disconnected. They are not realizing that they're sometimes 11, 12-year-olds already know what it's like to be approached. We just assume that our schools are safe, that they're going to school and they're doing these things. But 95% of our kids are on an iPad or an iPhone or on the internet. They know. Let's have that conversation with them, expose them to the ideas.
What did he think of that role playing?
Well, he laughed at me a lot and he told me that nobody's going to do that, Mom. That's not how people try and sell drugs. So I said, oh, well, then why don't you tell me how people try? So it's a matter of informing each other back and forth. But he knows that he can talk to me.
Can you talk about your role in the HOPE Initiative, which is the Center County Heroin and Opioid Prevention and Education Initiative? What do you do with that?
What I do there is I'm a person on that committee with lived experience. I believe, so we have a number of committees happening around the state. A lot of communities are coming up and building these heroin opiate prevention or education programs, support groups. They're happening in a lot of places around the Commonwealth. What sometimes they're missing on those committees is a person with lived experience. So here in Center County, we have an amazing drug and alcohol office. We have amazing people all around this county that are coming to the table to try to figure out what we can do different. In those meetings, they give me a lot of hope. I really love those meetings because you're having the corner. Representatives from district offices are coming and saying, what can we do? How can we work together? They're trying different things. Do all of those things always work? No. But at least we're trying. And that's what I love about Center County. That's why I love to be a part of that organization, is we just have to keep trying.
What would you say to someone who's listening right now who is dealing with substance abuse disorder and trying to figure out next steps?
I'd tell that individual that you don't have to live like this. There is a different way to live. I know you don't see it. I know you don't feel it right now. But just grab a little bit of hope. Grab a little bit of hope and do the next right thing. And if you can keep holding on to that tiny seed of hope and putting together a few steps, I promise you life can get better. You're worth it. You're loved. We have a family here in the recovery world, and we're waiting for you.
Danielle Dormer, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for letting me speak.
Danielle Dormer is a mother and Army veteran in long-term recovery from drug and alcohol use. She uses her experience to help Penn State students, serving as the assistant program coordinator for the collegiate recovery community. This episode of Take Note is part of State of Emergency, searching for solutions to Pennsylvania's opioid epidemic. State of Emergency is a combined effort of newsrooms across the state to draw attention to programs, therapies, and strategies that are showing promise in the fight against this public health crisis. Hear more Take Note interviews on our website at wpsu.org/take note. I'm Shireen Stanford, WPSU.